Aloha, and welcome to a special post-election day edition of The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman, in for Catherine Cruz. We're about to go to NPR's special coverage of the first post-election remarks of Vice President Kamala Harris. We're expecting this will be her concession speech. We're planning to carry those remarks live, and then we'll be joined by our government reporter Ashley Mizzouo and local political commentators Colin Moore and Neil Milner. All here on KHPR, Honolulu, KKUA Wailuku, KANO Hilo, KHPH Kailua Kona, KIPL Lihue, and KJHF Kaualapuʻu, collectively the stations of HPR 1. We're also inviting you to join us with your phone calls. What are you thinking and feeling today? The numbers to reach us are 808-941-3689 on Oahu, 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands. And now to NPR.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In just a few moments, we expect to hear remarks from Vice President Kamala Harris, her first since the effective end of a history-making run for president, and her first in front of a large crowd since her final day on the campaign trail Monday.
My entire career has been driven by a singular purpose, to fight on behalf of the people. On behalf of the people.
Her remarks will come hours after she called President-elect Donald Trump to congratulate him on his victory in the race. In a statement, the Trump campaign acknowledged Harris's, quote, strength, professionalism, and tenacity. Harris will speak from the campus of Howard University here in Washington, D.C., and we'll bring that to you live as soon as it begins. First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A large crowd's gathered on the grounds of Howard University in Washington, D.C. to hear Vice President Harris and LM deliver her concession speech. Harris has already reached out to President-elect Donald Trump to congratulate him. According to the Trump campaign, both leaders agreed on the need to unite the country. Today, the Associated Press called Michigan for Trump. That state, along with Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, which also broke for Trump, make up the so-called blue wall. Jackson Katz, creator of the Man Card documentary, 50 Years of Gender Power and the American Presidency, offered this take on one of the big factors that played into Trump's success.
The data is very clear that the Biden economy, if you will, including with investments in blue-collar industries and all kinds of that will create and have been creating thousands of blue-collar jobs, are actually real. But the narrative in the podcast universe, in the social media universe for low information, low engagement male voters, especially young male voters, is that the Biden-Harris economy and the Biden-Harris campaign and the Biden-Harris presidency was very bad for blue-collar men and for men in general.
NPR's learned that special counsel Jack Smith is taking steps to wind down his two criminal cases against Trump. Here's NPR's Kerry Johnson.
Justice departments led by both Democrats and Republicans have concluded a sitting president cannot be indicted or tried on criminal charges. That's prompted special counsel Jack Smith to engage with DOJ officials about walking away from the two indictments against Trump. The president-elect has pleaded not guilty on four felony counts in connection with his effort to cling to power in 2020. In a separate case in Florida, the DOJ has been appealing a judge's decision to dismiss charges against Trump for hoarding classified documents and obstructing efforts to retrieve them. Both cases are expected to wind down before Trump's inauguration in January. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
On the heels of Trump's decisive win, U.S. stocks surged. NPR's Marie Aspen looks behind the numbers.
Investors see Trump as friendly to business interests, particularly in terms of cutting taxes and regulations. Now they're piling into the Trump trade, buying up stocks and other assets that are expected to do particularly well under his administration. Shares in big banks jumped on expectations of lighter government oversight. So did the price of Tesla, the carmaker run by Trump supporter Elon Musk. Other financial winners at the moment are Trump Media, the parent company of his Truth Social network, whose stock has had some wild swings this year, and the price of Bitcoin. The crypto industry had poured money into these elections, and Trump has promised to turn the United States into the crypto capital of the planet.
This is NPR News. The National Weather Service is warning about extreme wildfire conditions in Southern California due to high winds. NPR's Nathan Rott reports 70 to 80 mile per hour wind gusts are raking across parts of L.A.
The winds have been howling over the greater Los Angeles region since early morning, causing power shutoffs and fueling at least two new wildfires to the north. A red flag warning is in effect for much of Los Angeles and Ventura counties and further inland through Friday, meaning there's a potential for, as the National Weather Service puts it, extreme life-threatening wildfire behavior. Nathan Rott, NPR News, Ventura, California.
There's word this afternoon that a fire broke out in Ventura County, starting in a remote mountainous area, but the winds pushed it toward the city of Camarillo. Butterflies are a classic symbol of rebirth. A small Ohio town is celebrating its multiple meanings with a sanctuary for them. Nick Swartzel of member station WVXU has more.
Floods have ravaged Ohio river town New Richmond many times over the years, and it's felt the harsh impacts of the nation's addiction crisis. Now, a partnership between the village and an addiction recovery center has established a butterfly garden where a flooded-out house once stood. Gary Cunningham lives in the recovery center. He helps tend the garden.
Being able to go over there and just take care of it, knowing it's ours, you know, and these seeing the butterflies, like they've been in the same journey with us.
Village officials hope to establish more green space on former floodland in the future. For NPR News, I'm Nick Swartzel in New Richmond.
The Dow's closed up more than 1,500 points or 3.5%. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Any moment now, Vice President Kamala Harris will deliver her concession speech. She'll be speaking at Howard University here in Washington, D.C., the historically black college she attended, where she had hoped to give a victory speech last night.
While we wait, we're joined in studio by NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid, who has been covering the Harris campaign. Also with us is Franco Ordonez, one of our correspondents, who is live from West Palm Beach, Florida. Franco, I want to start with you, if we can, as we wait. You were in the room last night when Trump took the stage. What was his message to supporters on the cusp of winning a second term?
I mean, one is a more positive message than we've, you know, heard from him recently. He was kind of humble and thanking Americans for the honor of electing him or re-electing him to the office. He did boast of his diverse coalition of supporters that got him across the finish line, including Latinos, particularly male Latinos, as we've been reporting. He called it the greatest political movement in history, and he did say he had a mandate to lead. It was interesting that he did not mention his opponent, though, last night, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris in his speech last night.
As you listen to him, Franco, I'm curious, the message that you heard from him, was it a message for Trump's faithful, or was he speaking more broadly to the nation, including those who did not necessarily support him?
I'd say it was a bit of both. I mean, he did call for unity, and he said it was a time to, or he would work to help the nation. You know, we did not hear, you know, the grievances and promises of retribution that we've been hearing so often on the campaign trail, especially these last couple of weeks. But he also went back to his, you know, he went to his campaign speech and he went to immigration, but he did, you know, he did kind of tell, you know, these stories from the campaign trail. He told meandering stories about top supporters such as Elon Musk and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who he said would have a prominent role in healthcare. And he also brought on stage Dana White, the CEO of Ultimate Fighting Championship, and he spoke and he attacked Trump's opponents, you know, called in the political machine against Trump, and he actually called it karma against the prosecutions against Trump, speaking of Trump's victory. And I would say that's a message to the base and not the rest of the country.
If you're just joining us, we are expecting to hear any moment from Vice President Kamala Harris delivering a victory speech on the campus of Howard University. Asma Khalid is here in the studio with us. You've been covering her campaign for months. What have these last 12 hours or so been like for her staff and her supporters?
Her supporters? Yeah, I mean, I spoke to someone who was there last night at Howard, supporter who's on the National Finance Committee, and said that, you know, folks were waiting at Howard for hours. They had hoped to hear from the vice president. Some people thought it was somewhat disrespectful not to come out and address the supporters in that moment. But look, broadly, I think they were disappointed, but they are disappointed with the results here, Ari. I mean, I've been getting messages from some Democratic sources. Disappointing, horrible are the words I'm hearing. They did not expect the night to go as it did.
I'm really curious what this means for the future of the Democratic Party when the so-called blue wall states have now gone red in two elections out of the last three, and many demographic groups that Democrats thought were reliably in their corner are breaking for Donald Trump.
You know, Ari, what I'm hearing from some Democratic sources right now is that it's going to require a lot of soul searching, and in part because this looks like it was a wave election. You look at every demographic group, essentially almost every demographic group across the board that the exit polls assess, they all shifted more rightwards towards Trump. That suggests that there was a broad national just discomfort with the direction of the country right now. Folks were unhappy about the economy. They were unhappy about immigration. Some folks in, you know, particularly the state of Michigan, you look at those margins, many folks, they were unhappy about the state of the war in the Middle East. So there's a lot of reasons why folks were unhappy.
Franco Ordonez, back over to you. This was a big night for Trump, but not just for Trump. Looking at the map, as Asma just alluded to, it was a big night for Republicans across the board. Sum up for us, how's the party feeling right now?
Well, I'd say they're feeling very good. I mean, Republicans took back control of the Senate after 4 years in the minority. They're now in a position to play, you know, a big, big role in nominations and appointment of federal judges, not to mention the potential of Supreme Court justices. You know, the House is still to be determined, but Speaker Johnson is expressing a lot of confidence, and he's already promising a very aggressive agenda for the first 100 days of the Trump administration on things like the border, on energy, and extending Trump's tax cuts that he implemented in his first administration.
We are still waiting for Vice President Harris to address the nation after her loss to President-elect Trump. But Franco, I do want to ask you, covering a number of these Trump rallies, he's made a lot of promises during his campaign suggesting what he would do as president. What can you tell us about some of his plans for day one?
Yeah, he's been pretty specific about some of those plans. I mean, he's boasted that he's going to close the border. He said he'd do that actually in the first few hours of his administration. He's promised to start drilling the iconic chant that he said in almost every rally, drill, 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 baby, drill. He's promised to gut Biden's climate subsidies and renew energy exploration. You know, he's talked about those tax breaks as well that I talked about before. He wants to continue those. You know, he's made very, very clear that his goal, his main goal, is to unwind President Biden's policies and resume where he left off after his first term in office. You know, in addition to that, on the foreign policy front, I mean, you can expect him to start waving, you know, this threat of threats, which he says is his favorite word, against not only adversaries, but most likely allies. And he's also promised to end the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East. He said he'd be able to end the fighting in Ukraine actually before he even took office, though he never gave specifics on that.
Asma, I'd like to ask you about the role of gender in this campaign, because as much as the Harris campaign explicitly made their appeal to women, the Trump campaign explicitly made an appeal to men as well, with advisor Stephen Miller even saying on social media, and I'm paraphrasing, if you know a man who hasn't voted yet, get him to go out and vote. Can you talk about the role that gender played here?
Look, if you assess the election results based on the exit polls we've seen, you don't see that Democrats came out. You don't see that Harris was able to accrue a whole bunch of additional support from women, which I think was very important given the way they leaned into that demographic.
Particularly white women.
Exactly. Exactly. To your point, you didn't see a big bounce given that it was so much of a focus, not just with who she was and what she represents, but also just given the fact that she really leaned heavily into the issue of abortion and reproductive rights. On the flip side, though, you see Trump doing significantly better with a whole range of demographic groups, men, but all sorts of men, right? Latino men, black men. You've seen a shift. You see Harris not gaining as much support either with young voters, as Joe Biden did 4 years ago. I mean, look, I think I've heard a lot of explanations about what went on. Some folks saying that she joined the ticket sort of late. She didn't go through a primary process, didn't necessarily coalesce her base of support before she ended up pivoting towards courting centrists and moderates. But Democrats are going to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what went wrong, where their headwinds, is this unique to the particular circumstances, and what they need to evolve going forward.
Franco, a question for you. The Trump campaign, the former president, President-elect Trump, had a persistent thread of anger and grievance in his remarks. He talked a lot about retribution for his critics, his supporters and advisors, often felt the need to walk those comments back. Now that he has won, now that he is the president-elect and eyeing that second term, is he backing away from that posture?
I really doubt that he is backing away from that posture. I think he, you know, certainly in the first speech after winning the presidency, or, you know, when he was on the cusp of winning the presidency, I think he was seeking, as we discussed before, a little bit of a thing of unity. But having covered Trump for, you know, much of the last decade, during his administration, he never held back from grievances and promises of retribution. Now, how much will he carry those things out? Will he go after people like former Congresswoman Liz Cheney? You know, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But, you know, he is very, you know, he always says that he has a very good memory. He doesn't get mad. He gets even.
I want to bring in NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson now as we wait for Vice President Harris to deliver her concession speech. Mara, what does Trump's victory here say about the American electorate more broadly?
Well, Trump won decisively. I mean, when he said last night, it was, which is his usual method, modus operandi, this is a political victory that our country has never seen before, he actually wasn't exaggerating. He won this election fair and square. He won the Electoral College. He's expected to win the popular vote. It hasn't been called yet. And he's only the second Republican to win the popular vote since 1988. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush won it in 2004. He did better with every segment of the electorate compared to how he did in 2020, except for white college-educated women and voters over 65. And as Asma said, he made big gains with Latinos. He improved his margin in every single county of the country. Harris couldn't flip a single county that Biden had lost last time. So his win was very broad. And when he says he now has a mandate, every president-elect says that. But he has a little more reason to think that, but because his win was so decisive.
What do you think this election was about? Inflation, the border, a vote against Biden,
yes,
a vote for Trump?
I think it was mostly about inflation and the border. Those were the two top issues for voters. And over again, they said that their reason for voting for Trump was because prices were lower during his administration. And that is how they remember it. And they assume that he can do the same thing, although presidents don't have a whole lot of control over prices. But that was the main thing. Also, the Biden administration was historically unpopular. Biden himself was seen as too old. Some of his stimulus legislation is considered to have added to inflation. Kamala Harris, for a while as his vice president, was even less popular than him. She did run a very, very competent campaign, very short and compacted, but she closed the gap. But she just couldn't ever establish a lead over Donald Trump. And that tells you that the people want what Donald Trump is selling. Now, what's interesting to me is once he gets into office, what are people expecting to get? I think at the very minimum, they're expecting to get a strong border and lower prices. And let's see if he can deliver on those two things.
Mara, I want to jump in here just to set the scene. Vice President Harris is expected to speak shortly at Howard University, her alma mater. This is where she had sort of a festive event last night. We're hearing from our colleague, White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. It's not as crowded there as it was last night. There are large sections of bleachers in the back that are empty, music not blasting like last time around. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, an ally of Vice President Harris, is there, as well as campaign manager Jen O'Malley Dillon, who is going around and hugging staff, a number of other folks there. Asma, as we wait, I am curious. One of the big things that we have been curious about, given that the speech is happening at a college campus, is young people, whether they would turn out in droves to support Democrats in the Harris campaign again. What can you tell us?
according to the initial results we've seen in the analysis, it does not appear that Harris had the support from young people that Biden had 4 years ago, and that certainly a candidate like Barack Obama had when he famously did historically well with young voters. You know, to echo one thing Mara said, though, there, I think that the biggest challenge for her is that she is the sitting vice president to a President Biden who has not been popular, and she was never able to untether herself from that and articulate how she would fundamentally be different than the current administration. And that was one of her biggest challenges.
As we wait for Vice President Harris to take the stage and deliver this concession speech, I want to bring Franco Ordonez back in. And Franco, as you said, we don't know yet whether Republicans will control the House, but they seem to have a very good chance of it. If they do have this trifecta of the House, Senate, and the White House, it would be the first time in many years that Republicans have controlled all three. What would that mean for governing the United States?
I mean, I mean, it's kind of hold on to your hats if you're a Democrat. And, you know, it's a very exciting time if you are a Republican, a conservative, a supporter of Trump. I mean, the House Speaker Mike Johnson has talked about a very bold agenda. He has, you know, told reporters that he has already told Trump that he could do stuff that no other president has done before, including, you know, extending the tax cuts, taking a big whack to some of the energy, you know, pulling back on some of the energy things that,
but if
that
I may,
Biden
Franco,
has done.
Tax cuts, energy policy, those are sort of typical Republican agenda items. Donald Trump has talked about going much, much farther, dismantling parts of the federal government, restructuring the way the federal government works, kind of from the ground up. I mean, is that something we're likely to see early on?
I mean, I think he has two, with total control of both houses, he's going to have 2 years of a big axe to kind of take at those things if he wants to. And you're right. He has said he's going to take a very deep look at the Department of Justice, at how foreign policy of, you know, of the Department of State, of all the big agencies. And I can assure you that, you know, the officers in that area are doing. He's talked about going after the deep state. Now, he's pushed back on Project 2025, which kind of outlines a way that Trump could kind of change the federal workforce. But it's actually out of that key aspect is part of an executive order that he actually implemented at the end of his administration. So many of his allies, some of his top allies, expect him to introduce this executive order again, which would allow him to kind of change the federal workforce to an amazing degree, make them kind of work for hire, allow him to fire those people and implement people who would be more willing to put his policies in. So it would be an elimination of many of the guardrails that were known in the first administration. And he would be able to have, he would have a lot more power if he's able to get that through.
And Franco, one thing I want to just chime in.
You've been listening to NPR special coverage. We are waiting for Vice President Kamala Harris and her concession speech. But we are going to break in, and we'll be back to that when she begins. But we're breaking into that to shift our focus to what was an unusual election night for Hawaii. We wanted to talk about that a little bit on the conversation this morning. We have government reporter Ashley Mizuo is here. Local political commentators Colin Moore and Neil Milner also would like to get your thoughts as we go through this. 808-941-3689 on Oahu, or 1-877-941-3689 on neighbor islands. Colin, let me start with you just in terms of your initial reaction to the state and local elections here in Hawaii.
Well, it was a good night for Republicans nationally, and it was a good night for Republicans locally. It looks like they're going to pick up one Senate seat and two, perhaps even three seats in the House. All of these are clustered, for the most part, on the west side, Waianae, Ewa Beach. I mean, these districts appear to be emerging as real red districts. I think there was some question last time when a couple of these incumbents, folks like Diamond Garcia, won their seat, whether that was due to the fact that they were running against relatively weak Democrats. Now it seems because they've won re-election that these areas of Hawaii are emerging as very solid Republican districts.
And Ashley, this is something that you've been reporting to in the run-up to the election itself.
Yeah. I think it's really important to look at these geographically, seeing kind of where these clusters are, you know, clustering across, you know, the state with it in leeward Oahu and, you know, kind of spreading a little bit into central Oahu when you look at it. Like, for example, state representative District 32 race between Garner Shimizu and Micah Ayu. That's, you know, IAM Moanalua Fort Shafter area. And it's a really close race, but it's looking more and more like Garner Shimizu, the Republican, might take that in the end.
Neil, your view from 30,000 feet or thereabouts?
Well, if you look at a more historical view here, the challenge for the Republicans is still pretty much the same. They increase, to say it in a flattering way, incrementally, which means very, very few at a time. Other than the IAEA one, which is kind of interesting, that's gone Republican in the past, but not for a long time. There's the competitiveness is still in the same area that it's been in for a while. So short term, it's a pretty good thing. Long term, you have to take into consideration the ability to move outside of that. The bar is still what the number of Republicans that were around when Linda Lingle was the governor, and it's considerably higher than it is now or than it has been for a long time.
Go ahead. I was going to say, but Neil, would you characterize this as a sort of different brand of Republicans? I mean, that's sort of what I'm seeing emerging, a more MAGA-oriented, very conservative brand, not like the Linda Lingle,
I think that's
Gentlemen, let me interrupt for a moment. We see Kamala Harris approaching the podium here, and I believe we're going to go back to NPR special coverage.
Thank you. So let me say, and I love you back. So let me say, my heart is full today. My heart is full today, full of gratitude for the trust you have placed in me, full of love for our country, and full of resolve. The outcome of this election is not what we wanted, not what we fought for, not what we voted for. But hear me when I say, the light of America's promise will always burn bright as long as we never give up. And as long as we keep fighting. To my beloved Doug and our family, I love you so very much. To President Biden and Dr. Biden, thank you for your faith and support. To Governor Walz and the Walz family, I know your service to our nation will continue. And to my extraordinary team, to the volunteers who gave so much of themselves, to the poll workers and the local election officials, I thank you all. Look, I am so proud of the race we ran and the way we ran it. Over the 107 days of this campaign, we have been intentional about building community and building coalitions, bringing people together from every walk of life and background, united by love of country, with enthusiasm and joy in our fight for America's future. And we did it with the knowledge that we all have so much more in common than what separates us. Now I know folks are feeling and experiencing a range of emotions right now. I get it. But we must accept the results of this election. Earlier today, I spoke with President-elect Trump and congratulated him on his victory. I also told him that we will help him and his team with their transition, and that we will engage in a peaceful transfer of power. A fundamental principle of American democracy is that when we lose an election, we accept the results. That principle, as much as any other, distinguishes democracy from monarchy or tyranny. And anyone who seeks the public trust must honor it. At the same time, in our nation, we owe loyalty not to a president or a party, but to the Constitution of the United States. And loyalty to our conscience and to our God. My allegiance to all three is why I am here to say, while I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign. The fight for freedom, for opportunity, for fairness, and the dignity of all people. A fight for the ideals at the heart of our nation, the ideals that reflect America at our best. That is a fight I will never give up. I will never give up the fight for a future where Americans can pursue their dreams, ambitions, and aspirations, where the women of America have the freedom to make decisions about their own body and not have their government telling them what to do. We will never give up the fight to protect our schools and our streets from gun violence. And America, we will never give up the fight for our democracy, for the rule of law, for equal justice, and for the sacred idea that every one of us, no matter who we are or where we start out, has certain fundamental rights and freedoms that must be respected and upheld. And we will continue to wage this fight in the voting booth, in the courts, and in the public square. And we will also wage it in quieter ways, in how we live our lives, by treating one another with kindness and respect, by looking in the face of a stranger and seeing a neighbor, by always using our strength to lift people up, to fight for the dignity that all people deserve. The fight for our freedom will take hard work, but like I always say, we like hard work. Hard work is good work. Hard work can be joyful work. And the fight for our country is always worth it. It is always worth it. To the young people who are watching, it is... I love you. To the young people who are watching, it is okay to feel sad and disappointed. But please know it's going to be okay. On the campaign, I would often say, when we fight, we win. But here's the thing. Sometimes the fight takes a while. That doesn't mean we won't win. The important thing is don't ever give up. Don't ever stop trying to make the world a better place. You have power. And don't you ever listen when anyone tells you something is impossible because it has never been done before. You have the capacity to do extraordinary good in the world. And so to everyone who is watching, do not despair. This is not a time to throw up our hands. This is a time to roll up our sleeves. This is a time to organize, to mobilize, and to stay engaged for the sake of freedom and justice and the future that we all know we can build together. Look, many of you know I started out as a prosecutor, and throughout my career, I saw people at some of the worst times in their lives. People who had suffered great harm and great pain, and yet found within themselves the strength and the courage and the resolve to take the stand, to take a stand, to fight for justice, to fight for themselves, to fight for others. So let their courage be our inspiration. Let their determination be our charge. And I'll close with this. There's an adage an historian once called a law of history, true of every society across the ages. The adage is, only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. I know many people feel like we are entering a dark time, but for the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case. But here's the thing, America, if it is, let us fill the sky with the light of a brilliant, brilliant billion of stars. The light of optimism, of faith, of truth, and service. H.U. And may that work guide us, even in the face of setbacks, toward the extraordinary promise of the United States of America. I thank you all. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America. I thank you all.
You're listening to live special coverage from NPR News.
And you've been listening to it on HPR here in the midst of the conversation, Vice President Kamala Harris and her concession speech, a little more than 10 minutes, talking about saying my heart is full today, talking about the light of America's promise will always burn bright as long as we never give up and we keep fighting. Talked about resiliency and the resolve to take a stand, to fight for justice and to not concede the fight that has fueled this campaign. We are here, Bill Dorman, Ashley Mazur, government reporter, along with Colin Moore and Neil Milner, and we are shifting our focus a bit to what was an unusual election night for Hawaii in the midst of an unusual election night for the United States. We were talking before about the GOP here in Hawaii, and Colin, maybe to start off with you, out of the Harris speech, anything there that resonates, rings in the ears here in Hawaii?
Well, I think the most notable thing is just the tone of optimism she's setting. I mean, that is a very different tone than Donald Trump set 4 years ago. One thing I will say about Vice President Harris is I think she ran a very good campaign. I mean, it's not clear that there was a whole lot more she could have done to connect with the voting public. I mean, I think there was just a larger sense that her slogan, "We're not going back," well, a lot of people did want to go back. They wanted to go back to 2019. But I think most people will agree that her campaign was optimistic, it was positive, it was energizing, but she may have been trying to accomplish something that simply wasn't possible for the Democrats this cycle.
I think I'm a little bit more critical, not of what she said, and I agree with Colin on the tone that she took. But one of the things she said set me off to thinking more systematically about what I was thinking before. She talked about how hard they worked to build a more diverse coalition in community to community. The general rap about Trump was that he was doing the opposite. He was sticking to his base. It turns out that the Republican Party increased their diversity big time in this election. That is, virtually every group, with maybe the exception of college-educated women and older people, went more for Trump. Not necessarily in a big way, but the Republican coalition diversity is increasing. The Democratic one is not increasing, it's decreasing, and the Democrats have not found a way to talk to the people they're losing in any way that's essentially different from what it was for the labor movement in 1955, and for others, it's not working. It's not her fault, but it's not working.
It is a process, certainly in transition, and here in Hawaii, Ashley, if you look, I know that you were checking some of the historical comparisons in terms of Trump in Hawaii.
If we're looking at, you know, how Trump and has kind of fared out in, you know, 2016, 2020, and now 2024, he's made very slight but very tiny gains, and I think we may see a small bump of like 1%. Like, for example, in 2020, Biden came away with 63% of the vote here, Trump 34%, and right now Harris has 61.6% and Trump has 35.8%. So a small bump, and we're still waiting for some results to come in, and if they are mail-in votes, they will probably skew more Democrat, but we could see a small bump. And then when you look at 2016, there's definitely a small, but like you can see the difference of a bump there.
Let me step back to what on the Hawaii stage on election night was perhaps one of the biggest surprises, and that's over on Hawaii Island and the mayoral race. And I see nodding heads around the table, Ashley.
I think it was really shocking. I mean, the most recent printout that just came out about an hour ago showed that Mayor Mitch Roth was now losing by about 10 percentage points at this point. And I think one thing that I found really interesting is that, you know, Mayor Roth did actually have some, like, positive things to campaign off of, looking at the point in time count of homelessness, showing that, you know, maybe his 13-point plan did work, but in the end, it just wasn't enough. Like that that show of progress for him wasn't enough to beat, you know, Kimo Alameda in the end, I think.
I think Kimo Alameda really had three main things going for him. I mean, I think this was somewhat unexpected early on when he first started running his campaign in the primary. I don't think a lot of folks saw him initially as the favorite, but he came out with a very strong organization. I remember being over in Hilo back in June and seeing about 75 people out there sign waving for him, and I thought at the moment, this is a candidate we really need to be taking seriously. But Alameda was able to present himself as the change candidate. Last night on TV, I think he said the word change about 10 or 12 times. I mean, that's always a good thing when folks are frustrated. We know folks on the Big Island are frustrated about the cost of living and housing. You know, Mayor Roth himself is a very process-oriented candidate. He's a lawyer. He's not quite as charismatic. But the thing that really put Kimo Alameda over the edge was the power of public sector unions. Without the endorsements from HGA, UPW, I don't think that he would have been able to command that level of support. So part of it did come down to his decision not to offer a generous hazard pay to county workers, because Alameda, just as a change candidate, probably wouldn't be enough. But as the change candidate, plus in part the establishment establishment candidate, because public sector unions have a lot of power on Hawaii Island, that was plenty. So I wasn't so surprised that he won last night. I was surprised that he won so decisively, though.
I think there's a couple of other things, one of which is that the neighbor islands tend to have much more competitive and, frankly, exciting politics than we do here. And secondly, this is the second mayor in the last two elections, incumbent, who have lost. The mayor of Maui lost. So you're far less likely to see that here. I mean, if you compare it, Rick Belangiardi had essentially no challenge.
Yeah,
right. You don't even have to say essentially, because no one in this room can remember the name of that one person who was on the ballot.
It was Toon James. Yeah. But
you get paid to remember that.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, let me ask you this, Neil. The shift, talking about the shift in approach in campaigning, mm-hmm. you see certainly that you referred to that, Colin, with Kumail Almeida. I'm thinking of Brent Nowak, who just stepped back from campaigning, took a different approach. Is there something broader that we take from this when we think about the political atmosphere in Hawaii, campaigning in Hawaii?
Go ahead, Colin.
Senator Awa, she told both Neil and me that he sort of saw this as an experiment. Can you win really without campaigning in the traditional way? He is a genius at what we would call earned media, generating kind of opportunities to get media coverage. He has a very strong social media presence. So I don't think it's really fair to say that he didn't campaign. He just campaigns in a very different way that I think is becoming increasingly powerful, as he demonstrated, particularly in a district like he represents. Like, it's a geographically huge district. It's hard to talk to folks. It's very hard to knock on all those doors. But you know, he's done some very successful things, like planting coconut trees. I mean, he was the last person to vote at Kapolei Hale. I mean, that was a kind of stroke of brilliance for his brand. I think you're going to see more candidates follow that. I think that's a little more difficult for folks sometimes in the media to track, because we're really attuned to looking at flyers and signs and the traditional ways of campaigning. But if you look at the activity on social media, I think Brent Nowak and some of the other Republicans have been uniquely successful that way.
And I would say during this past legislative session, he really did make a name for himself, really hunkering down on cutting back on it. Outsider investors buying homes here in Hawaii. And that's a huge issue, I think, for many Hawaii voters, feeling like they're being priced out, they can't find housing. And that might be one of the biggest, issues that we face here in the state, housing, and him kind of owning that and making that so integral to his brand as a politician, I think really helps boost him, even though he's not necessarily out there campaigning on those things. When you think about, outside investment and some people trying to ban that here, you think about Brenton Awa because he's so vocal about it and so forceful about it at the legislature, regardless of whether that legislation passes or gets traction or not. He certainly is boosting it on social media, and he does have a big following, I think.
It changes the notion of incumbency at least a little bit. I mean a little bit, because most people aren't going to try to do it this way. But incumbency generally has two advantages. One is name recognition. Two is money. Well, and then the third one is getting support of big organizations. He may have had the name recognition, although you can't rely on name recognition from the local newspapers, because they don't really cover Republicans very well. But the other kinds of things that he's been able to pull off are pretty interesting. I don't think there's a lesson to be learned there yet, and that's not saying anything against Brenton. It's just... It's odd enough. But the other thing is, it does add a kind of excitement and willingness to take risks that it's safe to say you almost never find in local and state politics.
I do want to draw a distinction between Brenton and Samantha DeCourt, the other Republican senator who won, and I would maybe even include Garner Shimizu, another Republican who won, and folks like Elijah Pirik, Diamond Garcia, maybe Representative Alcos. They represent themselves much more closely tied to conservative MAGA politics. I mean, they really identify with that brand. Brenton Awah really doesn't. He doesn't take opportunities to identify with the mainland Republican Party very, very often, in contrast to Diamond Garcia, who, for example, put on his website, Make Hawaii Great Again. That's a very obvious affiliation. So I'm sort of curious to see how this unfolds, because I really do see two different brands. One is very independent. I mean, in some ways, identifying themselves primarily as not Hawaii Democrats, not the establishment. And the other group of Republicans, the other cluster of Republicans, is very happy to identify with Trump and mainland Republicans.
But notice what's missing there, what we always used to talk about in Hawaii, which is moderate Republicans. There, when you and I started before the speech, there are no such thing. There is no such publicly recognized moderate Republicans anymore. If they exist in the legislature, they don't talk in that sort of way. And that's gone. I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with Cynthia Thielen, who maybe was the last really powerful, articulate, smart, very easily identified moderate Republican. She's 91 years old now, and no one has come along to fill that kind of gap. And there's no reason to think that they are. The Republican Party as a whole is a MAGA party now. They think differently. And you can see, by the way, you described the differences within them. That's got nothing to do with going across the aisle and meeting people.
You know, one theme that relates to that in terms of the idea of moderation, the idea of the middle, engagement. In terms of engaging the electorate and shifting, we saw that certainly in the national campaign. Is there anything that you're seeing in Hawaii in terms of a shift of approach in engaging the electorate, and does that have any implications for the state?
Well, the first thing is it's hard. You don't have to bother to engage the electorate if you're running unopposed, and we still have a chunk of those. I mean, you know, my representative, I haven't seen nor heard nor talked to him about it for a long period of time because he's unopposed. So that's still a primary driver here. I don't know if there's certainly the introduction of a little bit of big data, but that's been coming along a long time before. The model is still when the Democrats took over and built the strong case in the grassroots days with John Burns and Oshiro, right?
So the Trump campaign did something interesting. I don't know if local campaigns will try to follow this in the future, but one demographic they zeroed in on and saw this as a potential gain, which turns out they were right, is young men. They made a very conscious effort to start tailoring their campaign to young men. I understand that Donald Trump's son was instrumental in recommending podcasts and activities for him to sponsor, unusual ones. And I think if you glance through social media, you'll see a surprising number of young men, young influencers. They were very much pro Donald Trump, and I think that's a group that hasn't been actively engaged in that direct way in my memory. And so maybe some local campaigns will see this as an opportunity. Maybe Republicans will see this as a place where they can find votes in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting that you do say about, you know, these kind of like more obscure podcasts and stuff nationally, because even when you're looking at, you know, social media presence in Hawaii, a lot of the really popular meme pages, and I'm not going to name them on this because but you probably can think of several of them that you're probably following if you're on Instagram. They aren't necessarily like MAGA people, but they certainly do present things in a very conservative
bro culture
way. And I think like those have huge followings here, huge, more so than I think a lot of the media organizations here. And so it totally makes sense that that would actually work and appeal. And I think that's why we're seeing, you know, some of these Republicans who are, you know, more conservative socially, you know, making these kind of grounds. And it's clearly appealing because, you know, so many people follow these accounts and enjoy watching them. And yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say that, you know, we've been talking about influences in these direct races and candidates. Also issues, though, within issues within the election here in Hawaii, and the idea I'm thinking of Constitutional Amendment 1, which passed very, very easily. And
Yeah, that was a little surprising in that I think going into election night, even, you know, before the results came out, even proponents of Constitutional Amendment 1, which is the one about marriage equality, they were very concerned that it wasn't going to pass because the question was worded kind of confusingly and people didn't really understand. But in the end, they were able to, you know, eke it out there. And also the second constitutional amendment about judicial appointments that was super long, hard to understand, had absolutely zero education on it, even when it was going through the legislature, that also passed. And so I think it was kind of an interesting, that was maybe one of the most surprising things, is that both of those passed actually from our local elections last night.
And the idea also that as we go ahead past the election, looking forward to, it'll be January, but the next legislative session, are there things that we are seeing, I know it's early, but intimations of directions of focus of change? We're looking at leadership changes, certainly.
Yeah, well, one thing we're not seeing is the former Speaker of the House. And so how that's going to affect the pace and the kinds of legislation that moves forward, because unless the rules are changed, that's the Speaker has a whole lot to say about that. It's not clear to me yet whether there's going to be one compelling issue, which has happened in the past, the stuff that's starting to emerge, like the prison and so on, and the usual sustainability. But I don't get much of a sense yet that there's a groundswell for any particular issue.
My sense is one of the major issues is going to be talking through how we will end up paying for the huge tax cuts that were passed last legislative session. I mean, these will be implemented over time, but I think everyone agrees that if there isn't some adjustment, rather raising taxes in various ways or amending some of those tax cuts, we're heading towards a fiscal crisis. And so I think trying to solve that problem and talk through what balance of policies should be used to address that, I think will be one of the central issues.
You know,
I was going to say really quickly that, you know, I think when you're talking about that tax cut, that's why we're seeing some of the progressive Democrats and probably incoming progressives that won last night are going to be pushing whoever the new speaker is to implement some rule changes in the House because of the way that that tax cut was passed so quickly during conference, no hearing, just like kind of went through with not a lot of scrutiny. And that's why we kind of have this piece of legislation that wasn't fully vetted before it was passed and implemented.
And we have come to that time in the program where I'm going to ask you for your closing thoughts. In terms of the elections, can be a bit of national, can be statewide. Neil, your thoughts?
Well, I think two quick thoughts. The one we've already talked about, which was the enormous spread of the Trump support all across the country. And I don't mean that it was a large change all over. Just the kinds of small changes is certainly significant, because in some ways it may be transformative because the new new coalitions are forming. The one I want to spend a little bit more time on, not much, but the this whole issue about the gender gap. As far as I can see, the best research about this is very careful to say the following. There clearly are these differences in preference. That's begun to show up among the younger voters. If you look at their attitudes toward policy, it's not very different at all. And Richard Reeves, who's done the best work on this, says it's a mystery about why this is happening.
Just to put this in a little bit of international context, we're seeing throughout the world this global trend of anti-incumbency. It's not always right-left, but it often has been. I mean, in the UK, in Germany, I think the Canadian elections here will be devastating for the party that's currently in power. And so we didn't see so much of that here in Hawaii, except for maybe the Big Island mayoral race. But Donald Trump's victory does follow this trend of anti-incumbency throughout the world, or at least in advanced industrial nations.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the end, it really is that looking of consolidation of Republican power on the leeward coast. It was kind of my takeaway from it, and kind of just the widening spread of ideology between, you know, like we're saying, not a lot of moderate Republicans left in the state.
And Ashley, when you think of going back to work now that the elections are over in the or staying with the work that you've been doing, anything pop up as an interesting area of focus?
I mean, cost of living always top of mind, and you know, it's going to be about the fiscal health, I think, of our state going into the next legislative session. We have a lot of things that we need to pay for, still recovering from the wildfires in Lahaina, and, you know, doing fire prevention, and as well as like some climate change issues. And so I think it's going to really be come down to how much money we have to hit those issues coming up in this next legislative session.
That will be something that we will continue to watch. You know, one just short note on a national front. Financial markets had a very strong day today. There's a lot of talk about, well, banking regulations, this and that. The idea that this election was settled so quickly, I think that is being undersold in terms of a reason for a market boost. We'll see if that lingers or not. I do want to thank our guests who have been with us during this hour, along with the Vice President, and HPR government reporter Ashley Mizzou, and political commentators Neil Milner and Colin Moore. Thank you so much for joining us. And if you have a comment to share, we should mention that we're going to be bringing you full coverage throughout today. More to come on All Things Considered this afternoon. You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman in for Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.